Chapter 4. The Return of the Gods. A Mayan inscription can be found on Monument Number 6 in Tortuguero, a small place in the Mexican state of Tabasco, around 50 miles northwest of Palenque. Any Maya specialist can read the inscription. You start at the top left with the first glyph, then move right to the second, then down to the second line from left to right. The Maya experts read, Tzwatzahum, U Yashlahun, Baktun Chan Achau, Ush Uniu. It will be ended, the 13th Baktun, 4 Achau, 3 Uniu. It will happen, next glyph is broken off. Bolon Yokte will descend to, next glyph missing. So some god called Bolon Yokte will come down to earth on a certain day. If we convert this date to our calendar, it's December 23rd, 2012. What can we expect then on this date? And who is this Bolon Yokte? The very same Bolon Yokte appears on the so-called Vase of the Seven Gods. Here he is praised repeatedly as a holy one, a divine being who is involved in the creation of the world. Bolon Yokte was even involved at the very beginning of the Mayan calendar, on August 13th, 3114 BC. And in Temple No. 14 in Palenque, Bolon Yokte also appears in connection with an event that unfortunately cannot be deciphered from the glyphs. Either way, this unknown event happened on the incredible date of July 29th, 931449 BC. The date is clearly readable. In other words, it happened long before there were any Mayans around. Bolon Yokte also appears on page 60 of the Dresden Codex, one of the very few handwritten Mayan documents to survive the Spanish destruction, and yet again in the Chilambalam books. These were manuscripts written by priests, but not until after the Spanish conquest. Bolon Yokte is always mentioned in connection with great power. He must have been one of these mighty, awe-inspiring unknown beings that men could not otherwise explain. Bolon Yokte is not the only one who features in tales of second comings of the so-called gods. One can also infer the return of the gods from the Mayan calendar. How does that work, then? Several of the glyphs on the Tortuguero monument feature squiggles and vertical strokes. These are Mayan numbers. They are as ever-present in the Mayan world as the winged sun disk in Egypt. To at least understand the main track, that is, the one concerned with the return of the gods, you ought to know a little bit about the downfall of the Mayan culture, and also how the Mayan calendar works. I dealt exhaustively with this subject in one of my earlier books, Diatag, Andem di Gotekamen. Brutal conquerors. On Saturday, November 15th, 1519, Spanish conquistador Hernando Cortes, 1485-1547, waited with his forces a short distance away from Tenochtitlan. Set in the middle of a glittering silver lagoon, the city towered proudly with its mysterious and arcane temples, palaces, columns, and sparkling pyramid towers. Clothed in the magnificent uniform of an admiral, Cortes strode to the front of his small company. Crossbowmen and horses rode at the flanks, colorful streamers and flags fluttering from their lances, an honor guard for the future conqueror as he drew into the broad avenida in Tenochtitlan. The Aztec leader, Moctezuma, came down to greet the stranger, carried on a jewel-laden, gold-plated sedan by slaves who had lain out a long cotton carpet along the route. Cortes swung down from his steed, never taking his eyes off the Aztec leader for a second. C.W. Serum wrote about this meeting in his world-famous book on archaeology, Gods, Graves, and Scholars. For the first time during the great history of discovery, it so happened that someone from the Christian Occident no longer needed to reconstruct a rich foreign culture from the rubble of its remains, but rather was able to encounter it in the flesh. Cortes stood before Moctezuma, It was as if Brooks Bay suddenly bumped into Ramses, or Koldewey met Nebuchadnezzar during a stroll through the hanging gardens of Babylon, and they had been able, like Cortes and Moctezuma, to speak freely with each other. Moctezuma was, at that time, lord over 200,000 warriors. Despite the Spanish cannons, they could have destroyed the interlopers with ease. Why didn't Moctezuma choose to fight? Why did he rather choose the route of subservience? The answer lies perhaps in the Aztec religion, the same one, by the way, practiced by the Maya. The difference between the Aztecs and the Maya is predominantly a geographical one. The Aztecs lived in the highlands, the Maya in the lowlands. And just as the Jews await the return of the Messiah, the Muslims for their Mahdi, the Inca their god Viracocha, the son of the sun, like the South Sea Islanders yearned for the return of their god of reward, or the Egyptians for the return of Osiris from the constellation of Orion, so too waited the Aztecs and Maya for the return of their bringer of salvation, the Quetzal serpent. The Aztecs and the Maya lived according to precise calendar cycles. Buildings were erected in harmony with the calendrical rhythm, and feast days organized according to the calendar. We do just the same today. Christian festivals like Easter, Whitsun, and Christmas are dominant aspects of our year, and for our international sport events, such as the Olympic Games or the FIFA World Cup, huge infrastructures of new buildings are constructed. As luck would have it, Cortes's arrival coincided with the end of a calendar period, a time when expectations were traditionally high that the Quetzal serpent would finally return. The priests had preached of the event for a long time, and now, finally, the event that the legends had all foretold now also matched the date. The devout high priest Moctezuma could have, may have, or even must have recognized Cortes, this bearded white man, as at least an emissary of the Quetzal serpent. So he received his foreign guest with pomp and ceremony, and even offered him his palace to live in. Cortes enjoyed this generous hospitality for 3 days, and then he demanded that a chapel be built. Willingly, Moctezuma assembled a team of Aztec artisans to build the Christian house of worship. The Spaniards saw themselves as an occupying army, as indeed they were, and looked on suspiciously as the work progressed. On one wall they discovered a freshly plastered spot and suspected that a secret door had been hidden behind it. Secretly, they broke through the wall and found themselves standing in a room filled with gold figures, bars of gold and silver, jewel-encrusted adornments, and fine materials woven with feathers. Cortes estimated the value of the find to be around 162,000 gold pesos, around $10 million in today's money. During a feast to honor the god Teocalli, the Spaniards waited tensely for a prearranged signal. When it finally came, they struck with deadly effect, murdering 700 unarmed Aztec nobles and priests without warning. The Aztecs lost patience with their leader and overthrew Moctezuma. After making his brother king, they stormed the palace where the Spaniards were quartered. Suddenly, Tenochtitlan was thrown into bloody chaos. Cortes had his men burn down the temples and houses. While the Spaniards were abroad butchering the Aztecs with their superior weapons, none other than the toppled monarch Moctezuma, of all people, offered his services as an intermediary. The very idea! It was his last. On June 30th, 1520, his outraged countrymen stoned him to death. Cortes finally gave the order to pack up and carry off the treasure. Heavily laden with gold, silver, and precious jewels, the Spaniards planned to sneak out of Tenochtitlan. A watchman discovered the plunderers and gave out an alarm signal. The Aztecs set off hot on the heels of the Spaniards. The Night of Sorrows. This was the Noche Triste, the Night of Sorrows, for the Spaniards. They fled in panic. The heavy gold and silver weighed them down heavily. They stumbled and fell, some even drowned in the swamp. Aztec warriors killed great numbers of them. Horses and riders rode through a storm of buzzing arrows. They were bombarded with stones from slingshots. Lances tipped with obsidian, a crystalline stone with a tendency to splinter, pierced the bodies of the hated occupiers. In that terrible night, Cortez's company was reduced by half. He himself was sorely wounded, and the large part of the treasure that had roused their avarice had sunk in the waters and quagmires of the lagoon. Noche triste. Weeks later, Cortez returned with well-armed reinforcements. King Cuauhtémoc, Moctezuma's nephew, was then ruler of Tenochtitlan. He made a good job of defending his city, but under a steady bombardment from the Spanish cannons and siege engines, he was finally forced to capitulate. Cortez had free rein to tear apart the city to find its hidden treasures. Even under torture, though, Cuauhtémoc refused to reveal the location of the cache. So he was hanged. After all, this was not just gold, silver, and jewels, but also holy relics, manuscripts, and possibly even gifts from the gods. The Aztec treasure remained missing to this very day. Proud Tenochtitlan was finally conquered by the Spaniards in 1521. Its temples and pyramid, idols, stelae, and libraries were all buried in rubble and ash. Nowadays, Mexico City stands on the same site. Decades followed, during which all of Central America remained under the yoke of Spanish rule. In a series of bloody battles across the lowlands, the Spaniards defeated one Maya tribe after the other. The intractable indigenous peoples were brutally tortured, or often simply wiped out. They were forced to live under a reign of violence and terror, and soon, to add insult to injury, they also found themselves being struck down by epidemics. Before too long, the Spaniards hardly had to lift a finger to conquer regions or raise cities to the ground. As the old gods were forced to make way for the new religion under the sign of the cross, the Aztecs and Maya scattered in all directions of the compass. The once grandiose palaces slowly crumbled. The greedy jungle of the hot and humid rainforest gradually swallowed up the pyramids, penetrated the temples, and pulled down the platforms. Snakes, jaguars, and other kinds of tropical fauna made the sites their homes. Documents of inestimable value merely rotted away, becoming food for the ants and beetles. And the sun finally set on a unique culture with untold knowledge about those gods of the past. The Sign of the Cross. Ever more Spanish ships arrived in Central America. Hordes of adventurers, officials, treasure hunters, and priests made the trip over the ocean. It was all about gold and Christianization. 30 years after the destruction of Tenochtitlan, a certain young Spaniard arrived in the New World. His name was Fray Diego de Landa. He was born in 1524 to noble parents in Cifuentes, in the province of Guadalajara in Spain. This was the time of the church's great expansion, and it was accepted practice for all rich families to send one son or daughter into the church. Diego de Landa started his life in the Franciscan monastery in San Juan de los Reyes at the tender age of 16. Totally devoted to Christ, he prepared for his mission with the program of asceticism. Diego was just 25 years old when he was assigned to a group of young monks whose task it was to convert 300,000 natives on the Yucatan Peninsula. Intelligent and infused with the urge to serve Christ to the best of his ability, the young Diego learned the Mayan language in just a few months so that he was already able to deliver his sermons and holy dogma in Mayan by the time he arrived in the Yucatan. No wonder, then, that Diego was seen as a high flyer. In no time at all, he was made manciple of the new monastery in Izamal and started setting up satellite missions. After all, the land cost them nothing. They had taken it from the Indios, and slave labor was easy enough to come by. Diego de Landa dressed in rough woolen robes and personally monitored the education of the young Indios. Those converted to Christianity were soon filled with the same zeal as their master and destroyed the old shrines with the same enthusiasm that filled him. Diego looked with great interest at the mighty buildings of Tahoe, seeing them, however, only as sources of stone for the construction of the new Christian city of Mérida. Thus, the Maya temples became Christian cathedrals. The pyramids became the administration buildings for the Spanish rulers. Despite the fact that millions of polished stones were dragged to the new construction sites, Diego de Landa doubted that the supply of building material could ever be exhausted. The holy zealot Diego de Landa was finally made provincial head of the Order of Franciscans, before finally being made bishop of the new Christian city of Mérida. It made him furious when he saw Mayans still clinging to their old culture and rites, when they were not prepared to let go of their old gods. Thus, he gave the order to destroy all Mayan idols and writings. July 12, 1562, was certainly a dark day to remember. 5,000 icons, 13 altars, 192 ritual vessels, and 27 scientific and religious works, along with other illustrated manuscripts, were piled up in front of the church of San Miguel in Mani. At Diego de Landa's order, the whole pile was set alight. The flames licked, devoured, and consumed all of those irreplaceable documents of a grandiose culture. Ironically, the name of the city, Mani, translates as, "It's over." Unbothered by his act of cultural destruction, Diego de Landa noted, "We found a large number of books with illustrations, but these contained only lies and devilry. We burned them all, which sorely aggrieved the Maya, causing them to sorrow greatly." That sorrow lasts to this day, and not only among Maya researchers, but also authors like me. If only we still had access to those old texts, then we wouldn't need to arduously scrabble around, search for clues, so that we can painstakingly revive the knowledge that existed thousands of years ago in Egypt and India, and hundreds of years ago in Central America, and that was part of the established wisdom of the scholars of those times. For instance, knowledge about the visits by genuine gods, equals extraterrestrials, during the Stone Age. The Auto da Fe in Mani was just the start signal. In their blind zeal, the missionaries burned Maya manuscripts wherever they found them. Using the justification that it was the devil's work, Bishop de Landa destroyed every trace of Mayan culture that was connected to the gods, just like in Peru and Bolivia. See Chapter 1. Mayan Writings. Despite this, and it's certainly a little joke of history, who do Maya researchers have to thank for delivering the keys to Mayan mathematics and the Mayan calendar? None other than the merciless Diego de Landa. For without him, we would not know the Mayan calendar or its numerical system, and we would know nothing about the return of the gods. How did that happen, you ask? Well, Bishop Diego de Landa, today he would be described as the hawk among the missionaries, somehow got caught in the firing line of the Spanish court. Informers brought back news to faraway Spain that Diego had even burned objects made of gold. Finding himself suddenly under pressure, Diego de Landa sought allies in the New World, allies who introduced him to the secrets of Maya knowledge. His teachers were the sons of the indigenous noble families. They were converts to Christianity and taught Bishop de Landa everything they had learned from their parents, one piece at a time. Diego de Landa noted everything down in Latin. He learned about the Mayan numeric system and the calendar, and also how their alphabet worked. And thus came about a veritable apologia with the title Relación de las Cosas de Yucatán, a report on things in the Yucatán. This text turned out to be a highly important source for Maya research, and it was rediscovered by pure chance. 300 years later, Abbé Charles-Étienne Brasseur, 1814 to 1874, a cleric working in the Royal Library in Madrid, discovered a rather unimposing document tucked between two gold-embossed folios. Brasseur, who himself had been a missionary for many years in Guatemala, was fascinated. Mayan glyphs and sketches stood out from the small, black Latin letters. In addition to these were a number of squiggles and short dashes, as well as short strokes placed over each other. By sheer coincidence, Brasseur had found the key that opened up the way out of the jungle of Mayan numbers and letters. Bishop Diego de Landa had written in his Apologia, "The most important thing the tribal chiefs carried around with their territories were their scientific books." His countryman, José de Acosta, went further. In the Yucatan, there were bound and folded books in which the Indios stored their knowledge of the planets, nature, and their ancient lore. Only 4 Maya manuscripts from pre-Spanish times survived the destruction in Central America. They are known as codices, and they can be found today in Mexico City, Madrid, Paris, and Dresden. The Madrid Codex was found by Abbé Brasseur, the same man who found the text by Diego de Landa, in the possession of a professor from Madrid's School for Diplomats. The Paris Codex was discovered in a waste paper basket of the Parisian National Library, and the Dresden Codex was brought to Dresden from Italy by Johann Christian Goetze, a librarian from the Royal Library. That was back in 1739. Goetze wrote at the time, "Our Royal Library now has the advantage over many others, for it possesses a rare treasure. It was discovered in private hands in Vienna, and had been kept more by chance, as its owner did not suspect its worth. Without doubt, it is from the estate of some Spaniard who is either in America himself or one of his ancestors was." Did not suspect its worth? Phew! These days the Dresden Codex is worth several million dollars. The 4th of the Maya manuscripts is called the Grolier Codex. It consists of 11 incomplete pages that discuss the planet Venus. All of the Maya texts are written on thin parchments made of bast fiber from the wild fig trees that grew in the area. Originally, the bark of the trees would have been made more elastic by treating it with the sap of the rubber tree. Then it would have been painted with starch from vegetable tubers and laid out to dry before being painted in 4 colors using soft feathers. Finally, the manuscripts were folded in a concertina-like fashion. The age of the Mayan manuscripts is unknown. If they are copies of older documents, as is likely, their content could be at least 2,000 years old, if not more. The Paris Codex contains prophecies, the Madrid Codex is a horoscope, apparently, and the Dresden Codex is filled with mathematical and astronomical relationships. All are now readable, thanks to Bishop Diego de Landa, who provided us with the key to the Mayan numerical system. The Dresden Codex. Maya scholars have been trying to crack the codices for 200 years. The meticulous academics have been able to reconstruct much, but just as much remains shrouded in the mists of interpretation. Professor Thomas Barthel, an expert in Maya writing systems, talks of an evident mixed character, because the same signs can sometimes mean completely different things. There are also blocks of hieroglyphics that are placed in the middle of a number text, or plays on words that offer numerous different possibilities for interpretation, whose senses are often completely at odds with one another. Nevertheless, what the academics have found is simply breathtaking. The Dresden Codex talks about Venus orbits, certain gods who are described as the lords of the heavens, a thunder and lightning god, and of course, the complicated Maya calendar. Maya academics have labeled the confusing panoply of gods with different letters. In the Dresden Codex, much is carried out by the gods A, D, E, and N, although it is often unclear which god is responsible for which deed. 6 leaves of the Dresden Codex contain astronomical profiles of Venus, 2 leaves discuss the Martian orbit, and 4 the Jovian orbit, and even its moons. Some of the pages are primarily concerned with the Moon, Mercury, and Saturn, but the constellations Orion, Gemini, and the Pleiades are also mentioned. Filled with complex calculations, the tables even present the reference points of the planets in relation to each other and their respective positions with regard to the Earth. Then come periods of Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars years adding up to 135,200 days. The ancient Maya even dealt with astronomical numbers of 400 million years. The Maya astronomy documented in the Dresden Codex is not fully understood, even today. Several folios talk of battles between the planets, and there are seven sheets of so-called eclipse tables containing the dates of every single eclipse from the past and the future. In 1938, Professor Herbert Noll Husum, the best-known Dresden Codex specialist of the age, wrote, "The eclipse tables are so ingeniously drawn up that they contain not only every single possible eclipse visible in the area for hundreds of years, but also even the not directly observable, purely theoretical eclipses are given exactly to the precise day." That observation was made 70 years ago. It still makes some Maya researchers uneasy. How could a culture that still practiced human sacrifice be such masters of astronomy, exhibiting skills that should have been far beyond their ken? Where did they get this knowledge? Where did the inspiration come from that told them that the planets had a predictable relationship to each other? Centuries of observations, a manic compulsion to create the perfect calendar, or even an addiction to mathematics does not explain this puzzle. As the Earth itself has an elliptical orbit around the Sun, and, of course, the other planets are not actually standing still, every observation is susceptible to a certain time lag. Venus, for example, only appears in the same constellation once every 8 years, Jupiter every 12 years. What's more, the Maya lived in a geographical area in which it was impossible to observe the stars at all for half the year. In the Dresden Codex, however, there are astronomical points of reference that only appear every 6,000 years. The Maya weren't even around for 6,000 years. Mere calculations are not enough to deduce that the orbit of Venus has to be put back a day every 6,000 years. Added to all this, the evidence points to the fact that the Maya were in possession of their astronomical knowledge from the very start, almost as if their tables and books of data and orbital calculations had just fallen to them out of the sky. One Maya specialist explained to me that these kinds of observations could be made in just a few decades. The Maya were a Stone Age people. Have we forgotten that? They possessed no modern measurement devices, telescopes, or computers. Even the archaeological objection that the Mayan priest astronomers on their tall pyramids would have been able to observe the starry skies without having to look through haze and clouds doesn't hold much water. The pyramid towers, such as those in Tikal, Guatemala, were astronomically aligned at the very planning stage. The astronomical knowledge is, therefore, older than the pyramids themselves. Where does the knowledge come from? 60 years ago, respected astronomer Robert Henseling shocked the scientific community with some of his conclusions about Maya astronomy. 1. It must be considered impossible that the Mayans had instruments and methods at their disposal for the precise measurement of angles and time. 2. There can be no doubt, however, that the Maya astronomers had knowledge of star constellations from thousands of years in the past, which included reliable information on their type and position on certain calendar dates. 3. This is incomprehensible unless corresponding observations had been made prior to this period, in other words, thousands of years before the beginning of the Christian calendar, by somebody somewhere and reliably handed down for posterity. 4. Such achievements, however, are dependent on certain factors. For instance, that in that very prior age there had been a development period of extremely long duration. Since then, the scant number of experts who have worked on the Dresden Codex are hedgy about making any meaningful comments. I believe that the core of the astronomical knowledge of the Maya must be much older than the academics are willing to concede. Even in classical Greece, an empire rich in top-notch mathematicians and brilliant philosophers, it was sacrilege to assert that the Earth moved around the sun. Anaxagoras, circa 500 to 428 BC, was accused of heresy and forced to flee his hometown when he claimed that the sun was nothing more than a glowing rock. Ptolemy of Alexandria, circa 90 to 168 AD, who had the benefit of the wisdom of hundreds of years of Egyptian and Babylonian astronomy at his disposal, placed the Earth at the center of his planetary system. It wasn't until Nicholas Copernicus, 1476 to 1543, came on the scene that there was any serious doubt of the matter. He postulated that it was in fact the sun that was at the center point of our planetary orbits. After him came Giordano Bruno, 1548 to 1600, Tycho Brahe, 1546 to 1601, Johannes Kepler, 1571 to 1630, and Galileo Galilei, 1564 to 1642, until at last the structure of our solar system, as indeed it came to be called, and the elliptical orbits of the planets were finally fully understood. Yet we are expected to believe that the Stone Age people from the Maya tribes discovered all this in just a few centuries without any reliable instruments? Native American traditions. It is hard to grasp. In Central America, there existed an ancient but highly precise canon of astronomical knowledge, closely connected to the gods who, for their part, A. came from the heavens, B. clearly were an awe-inspiring bunch, and C. quite often pushed mankind around. This knowledge came from a god they called Quetzal Serpent, although such a creature no more existed than a fire-breathing, flying dragon in China. The Mayans were by no means stupid. They wouldn't confuse a Quetzal bird with a thundering feathered serpent. This contradiction is simply not compatible with their astronomical expertise. On top of this, we shouldn't view the Maya knowledge in isolation. After all, their cousins, the native North Americans, lived close by, and they all knew the extraterrestrial Quetzal Serpent, even if it sometimes appeared in a slightly different form. The Tutuk Indians from the Pacific Northwest coast, United States, called the Quetzal Serpent the Thunderbird. One of their totem poles for this thunderbird serves as the symbol for the city of heavenly beings. The same designation is used by the Canadian First Nations people in British Columbia. Here, too, the Quetzal Serpent is known as the Thunderbird. It all seems so much more logical. The Pawnee tribe in today's Nebraska are convinced that man was created from the stars, and heavenly teachers came down regularly to Earth to tell the men and women more about the things they needed to know. We researchers of today treat the Maya wisdom in an isolated fashion, as if there had never been any other tribes or descendants in other regions that had maintained their lore and traditions in just the same way. The creation myth of the Cherokee, Northwest Georgia, starts this way. In the beginning, all living things lived and dwelled above in the sky. The occupants of the sky home were anxious to get down, for the sky home was getting more crowded all the time. The Miccosukee tribe, South Florida, claim, a long time ago, a tribe came down from the heavens to the Miccosukee swamps in the north of Florida. They swam onto the land and built the city of Miccosukee. The name of the Miccosukee Indians derives from this town. In British Columbia, Pacific coast of Canada, the Salishan people tell, once the Earth people wanted to make war on the Sky people. Also at home in Canada are the Ojibwe tribe, Ontario, Canada. According to their lore, they also belong to the society of the Sky people. These Sky people are not angels but humans with lighter skin and scarlet-red tunics with hoods. And of course, the Hopi Indians, Arizona, also speak of the heavenly teachers. They even make representations of these teachers in the form of dolls to this day. These are just a few examples from the North American continent. I can't shake off the feeling that the academic Maya specialists view their Quetzal serpent as something unique, but after reading through the millennia-old legends and histories of other cultures, it has become clear to me that the gods from back then, that is, the extraterrestrials, shared a lot of knowledge with our forefathers, most notably in the field of astronomy. And there are even eyewitness accounts from people who were there at the time and wrote of their experiences.